Experience of listening to them was quite disturbing, but it was also strangely validating because the two of you were discussing me in terms that I don't really see myself as an influential figure, as somebody that has some sort of standing in this community and that needs to be taken down or needs to be exposed, which is kind of ironically what I've done, as you are well aware, with figures like Whitley Strieber and Carlos Castaneda, what I've attempted to do, not necessarily expose, I think that's entirely negative, but to deconstruct and look at possible flaws in their teachings and even their personalities. So to find myself on the other end of that process was, as I say, strangely validating, but also disturbing. And go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, when you say validating, I didn't mean to interrupt your train of thought, but is that to say that you feel it validates your sense of significance as a world historical individual, i.e., the one, or that it validates the fact that you're following a similar path to Strieber and Castaneda, and thus will inevitably encounter the same sort of critical examination? Or how do you mean
Well,
that?
no, neither of those things. I simply meant validating in terms of my work actually having had an impact and an influence to the extent that people were challenging it and seeing it as you seem to frame it between you as some sort of threat, if that's not too strong a word.
Well,
Something that needed to be addressed because of the harm it might be doing to others. Obviously, that's not pleasant to be seen that way, but I mean, and perhaps it's tied into my own tendency, which I think many of us have, for negative identity, to have a sense to gain a sense of identity through opposition, and so the fact that I was that you were opposing me in this way, or I wasn't there, so you weren't really opposing me, but you were challenging me or confronting what I was doing in this way, gave me a more clear sense of existing, I suppose, out there.
that's interesting. Well, after all, personal identity is brought about via our relationship with other people, being reflected even through antagonism by another individual can reinforce the sense of a separate self and our sense of being inherently existent.
And I think that's very basic, that need to be validated or to have one's existence affirmed. But the sort of irony of it was that the things that you were saying on the podcast I felt were largely inaccurate. And so there was this double effect. On the one hand, I was having my existence and my influence validated by the mere fact that you were criticizing it so strongly. But on the other hand, the things that you were saying created a feeling of being totally misunderstood. Like I just, I wasn't, my message was not being received at all. And so to get back to your initial question, that it got my attention. I mean, that's the simplest way of putting it. And then when a friend, an old associate came forward and suggested that I talk to you. I was open to the idea. Because, I mean, as you said before we started, I'm not opposed to opposition. I think that, as Blake said, opposition is true friendship, and there's a potential when two opposing views meet that a third thing arises from that. That's the possibility for a real dialogue there. Because no single point of view is ever complete, therefore it's never actually right. We're fumbling in the dark, like the parable of the blind men and the elephant, and we're trying to describe our experience is really all it comes down to. And that's all I've ever really done or claimed to do, is to describe my experience. So in that, to that degree, everybody's perception is valid. It's just different degrees of delusion. So if you're seeing me this way, although I can say, well, that's not how I see myself, and that's not how other people see me, therefore you're wrong, I can't actually take that perception away from you. If that's your perception, then it's real to you. And I mean, I'm curious about that. I'm genuinely curious, although I was a bit annoyed at the time of listening to it and felt defensive. By now, you know, the water's under the bridge, and that I'm genuinely curious, like, what's going on here?
Well, I think that in what you're saying, you strike upon a significant point. You say that all perceptions are valid, albeit with varying degrees of delusion. Now, mm-hmm. to my mind, validity has to do with truth. And, you know, if on a straightforward surface reading, that would appear to be a contradiction. So I think if you'll allow me to take your statement as a convenient segue into something that I find objectionable in your work, it's this. The sense in which you use the word truth. There are different senses in which people say that something is true or valid. On the one hand, there is objective truth, which has to do with correspondence, representation, propositional knowledge. On the other hand, there is subjective truth that has to do with sincerity, integrity, and trustworthiness. And yet still, there is also intersubjective truth pertaining to cultural fit, mutual understanding, the sense of rightness that arises from people's coming together to find a shared locus of meaning within which they can meaningfully interact. I believe that when you conflate these, or when you promote one at the expense of the others, you can generate significant fallacies. What do I mean by that? What I perceive in your work is a recapitulation of the postmodern, or, and by extension, the New Age tendency to devalue or to disregard objective truth. And in its place, you could say, i.e., the broad thrust of what you might call extreme postmodernism, that intersubjective agreement is the only thing that yields the appearance of objectivity. But what I see you doing is holding up subjective truth as an actual picture of actuality, rather than seeing it as one domain of truth, i.e. the sort of truth wherein we can come to know ourselves or know another individual, either through introspection or through dialogue. You seem to take it as a way of knowing reality as such, and in so doing, lose part of the vital picture of what is and what we, in fact, might be as spiritual beings.
Well, I've done my utmost to follow you in that chain of reasoning. I've followed you rationally, like I've been able to follow the meaning of the individual sentences, but I think I'm at a loss to unpack what you've actually said in such a way that I can address it. Like, yeah, I don't want to seem simple-minded, but can you sum that up in a single sentence for me?
Well, let me try and do my best. I believe that the word truth is multivalent or ambiguous. There are different senses in which this word is used, a la bow and arrow versus bow on a present, or bark of a dog, bark of a tree. The sound is the same, but the underlying significance is subtly but crucially different. I think that I identified at least three kinds of truth: objective, mm-hmm. subjective, and intersubjective. And I said that you were emphasizing subjectivity at the expense of the intersubjective and the objective.
Well, first of all, I don't know what objective truth is. So I'm not really qualified to talk about that. And then intersubjective truth, I think by that you mean what I talk about as consensual reality, like an agreement that we all make on what's true. Is that roughly what you're referring to?
I would say so.
Like value systems, culture, things like this.
Indeed.
Social agreements, morality.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so I talk about that a lot, great deal. I tend to frame it as a negative, I think, as a group mind, as a matrix, as something that is preventing us from experiencing, first of all, our own truth, and then through an experience of our own truth, which is a full bodily experience, not a mental one, an experience of objective truth, which is my goal in life. I think it's everybody's goal who is self-aware enough to be attempting to individuate and attain authenticity and autonomy, that we're trying to get to the objective truth of ourselves through an experience of ourselves, through an honest, and I mean my take has been consistently that, starting with Matrix Warrior and then delving deeper into perhaps more traditional psychological models, is that we're prevented from perceiving reality by our own trauma, by our own patterns, by our own psychological complexes and constructs. So when we look at a partner, we don't see another human being. We see our mother or our father or our infant unmet needs and so on. Not to reduce it to cliche, but just to simplify it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, my attempt to get to grips with the truth in that larger objective sense has been inseparable, and that's my spiritual quest, has been inseparable from this kind of ongoing literary and other media process of trying to disentangle my own perception and experience of myself from the culture and the intersubjective reality that I've been, the matrix that has formed me, has shaped me. So you described three things as, and I still didn't quite understand how that was a criticism, even though I know it was, but you described these three things as somehow that they need all to be equally represented, or that, whereas I see them as inseparable, in a sense. Well, objective reality is isn't entangled with subjective reality and intersubjective reality, but it's obscured by it just to that extent from our point of view inside the matrix of our ego minds. We can only see objective reality through our patterns, which is roughly equivalent to saying we don't see it at all. We talk about it like God, but we don't actually see it. If you were to experience God, if one was to experience God, my assumption is anyway is that we wouldn't be able to talk about it, but we wouldn't want to talk about it.
Well, you bring to mind a few other points, and rather than dwell on what I was trying to express in my prior point, allow me to add to what I see as lacking or misconceived. Because you talk about trying to come to know objective reality, or at least the objective reality of the self, by means of becoming acquainted with our own personal patterns, by means of some encounter with and assimilation of the unconscious. Would you say that's fair?
I'd have to think about it. I mean, it's not how I would have chosen to phrase it. It's recognizing patterns in order to see oneself as separate from patterns, first of all.
In order to constructively disidentify from them.
Yes. I don't know about that word constructively, but creatively, spontaneously, organically, whatever. It's not a intellectual process I'm describing, even though it begins to sound like one. By using words.
Mm-hmm. Which brings to mind another point that I wanted to make on. The pre-trans fallacy comes out of the integral philosophy of Ken Wilber, an American intellectual who has labored for the past couple of decades to see whether there can be a common framework in terms of which different knowledge systems as diverse as physics, sociology, Western philosophy, and the world contemplative traditions can interact and mutually inform one another. The pre-trans fallacy is one of his key terms of art. It's something that he uses to make sense of a lot of the misunderstandings in the spiritual community or within an individual spiritual practitioner. And the idea of it is roughly this, that overall, if you take the developmental schema that have been proposed by different developmental psychologists, say Kohlberg, Piaget, Maslow, Gilligan, you could abstract from those schema an overarching pattern that's common to all of them, irrespective of the terms they use. Broadly, you could say that in the course of individual maturation and development, we move from a condition that is egocentric to a condition that is, in some sense, sociocentric or ethnocentric to a perspective that is worldcentric. So this movement in our cognitive development, in our interpersonal development, in our ethical development, in our emotional intelligence, moves through a pattern of increasingly broad identification, increasing care and concern for other sentient beings, and indeed the web of life. Now, what you can abstract is the overall pattern is pre-conventional, conventional, and trans-conventional, but more specifically that could mean pre-rational, rational, and trans-rational.
Mm-hmm.
So the confusion that often happens is people recognize that spiritual experience or gnosis is in some sense non-rational, okay? It's different from the ordinary or default mode of perception experience. However, they confuse pre-rational with trans-rational. Now, Wilber accuses people who are in awfully high standing in the spiritual community, or at least the intellectual branch of it, like Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung, of succumbing to this, of confusing the pre-individuated state with the post-individuated state, of confusing dissociation and regression with transcendence. Mm,
with enlightenment, familiar. I mean, not familiar with Wilber's work, but this line of thought is one that I've followed myself recently, or investigated.
All right. Well, if you'll allow me to carry on a little further, I can tie it into what I see here. Oftentimes, the phenomenological concomitants of spiritual experience are similar to a psychotic episode, are similar to a dissociative regression. And in consequence of that, we can say to ourselves, well, perhaps I'm making progress into the transpersonal domains when in fact you're doing just the opposite. Or studying things like, say, the mythopoetic value systems of agrarian and horticultural cultures that are pre-literate, pre-rational, and seeing those as a key to something which lies not in the past, so to speak, but in the future. You see, in Wilbur's view, and I don't want to tarry too long on anyone else's articulation of these patterns, but unfortunately I'll need to be expository in order to make my point. You've heard the phrase that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. It means, roughly, that in the course of development in the womb, we retrace the steps of evolution. We go from being a single-celled organism to being a multi-celled organism, to being an invertebrate, to being a vertebrate, to being a human being. Now, in like manner, you could say that in the course of human personal development, we recapitulate conscious history, because we begin with an undifferentiated state, to a roughly mythic and magical state where the laws of causality and the boundaries between self and other are not yet defined, to a state where we're individuated, to a state where we recognize in a more complex and nuanced way our interconnectedness with other beings, that there's this progression. And it's in that sense that pre and transrational, pre and transconventional are woven into our experience as human beings. Only when we aspire to something higher, we can turn around and go backwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I would say that I've recognized roughly what you're describing, although once again, the terms are very convoluted and very intellectual, I find, so it's difficult to keep up. But the essence of what you're describing, anyway, I would say is very similar, if not same, as what I'd recognized in myself and begun to unpack over the last couple of years since following John DeRuyter and then meeting Dave O'Shaughner. I'm not sure how I could exactly match those experiences with what you've described without going into a lot of detail. About a year ago or so, I posted on my blog something, post entitled, Is the Shaman a Schizo After All? And if you caught that one, but the essence of it was that, you know, for years I had been, you could say, in defense of the schizophrenic, in defense of the psychotic episode, exploring those states of mind, both directly and indirectly, with an eye to discovering or uncovering possible validity to them, that these were misunderstood and mishandled spiritual epiphanies or you know, genuine perceptions of objective reality that were then filtered through the ego and caused a breakdown of some kind. Nothing very new there. It's R.D. Lang was the most famous exponent of that. But so what I was looking at, what I started looking at a year or two ago, was kind of the reverse model of that. Well, to what extent, if a person isn't completely free of their patterns, of their past trauma, of their ego, in a specific sense, not in the Jungian sense of the word, but in terms of the false identity construct that prevents us from having a full open body experience of reality. If a person isn't free of that, to what extent do genuine spiritual epiphanies, or experiences of objective reality then get pulled down through the ego and turned into a kind of delusion? And to what extent have I, not a kind of delusion, but a delusion, but a specific delusion that I think that you're describing, Ken Wilber's talking about, which is a spiritualized ego in very simple terms. To what extent have I done that? To what extent have I created this surrogate reality in which I can recontextualize my trauma, my psychosis, my delusions in such a way that they make me not a victim of them, but empowered by them, let's say. And the answer was yes, to some extent, to a much greater extent than I'd realized I was doing this. And the result of that was that, definitely a not painless process, I was letting go of, I felt obliged to let go of a whole bunch of beliefs about experiences I'd had, dreams I've had, visions I've had, And of course, I've been through this before. I mean, this is very much a central thread to my public process. Like the media that I create has always been, from the start, it's just become more consciously so. It's always been a mirror of or a chronicling of this unveiling process, this self-exploration process, and it's always led at regular intervals to a confrontation with my own delusion. So if you were to say, well, you've done that in the past, I would say, yes, you're right. If you were to say that you're doing that now, I would say, well, yes, you're probably right, because I've done it my whole life, and so the chances are I'm still doing it now. Now, when you talked on your podcast with your friend, you talked about how, well, he's insane, but the fact that he says he's insane doesn't mean he's not insane. Like he's using that to make himself more credible. Well, I mean, that attributed a kind of calculating contrivance to me that I don't actually have. I'm not going to claim total ingenuity, but there is a certain amount of awareness of how I'm coming across and trying to make an impression. Of course, that's part of why I'm doing it. It's not entirely just to deconstruct myself. But at the same time, I'm trying to catch up. I'm always just catching up. Whatever I put out there, whether it's a book or a video or an article, it's a chronicling of a process that I'm going through at an unconscious level that my intellect is trying its best to observe, witness, and report. But what happens in that process, as I'm sure you've experienced yourself, is that the intellect gets above its station, let's say, or it begins to try and insinuate itself into the process to control it and direct it, which it can't do. The intellect doesn't have that power. I was going to say in my opinion, and it is, maybe it is just my opinion, but I do feel that this is more an opinion in my experience. Like the intellect is more like a recording device than actually a creative or a directing intelligence. So bringing this back to your initial point, the pre-rational, the rational, the post-rational, I mean, words are tricky. The very nature of what we're talking about. So, but I tend to sort of correlate intellect with rationality, with ego. Not to say that they're synonymous, but they do overlap. Perhaps it's symptomatic of our culture, where we. I think it has to do with language. It's something I'm exploring now. That language is the means by which our nervous systems get infiltrated by a foreign element that then takes over our nervous systems, takes over our conscious decision-making process, and so we become ego-bound rather than existence-bound. I'm very much free-riffing now because you put out so many different ideas. So anyway, that's, you know, what's out there that you're criticizing or experiencing or everything else is, it's always going to be flawed and limited. And I'm always attempting to reduce that, to minimize the flawedness of it, to make it as clean and clear as possible. And one of the ways that I've done that is by kind of constantly confessing. Like with the Whitley piece, okay, this is how I see Whitley, but wait, this is really all just about me. And it's kind of, you know, it's self-subverting to a large extent, because I do risk that the work that I do can be rejected on that basis or on other bases. But I hope that the work itself will speak for itself. So with Whitley, I felt that I did uncover certain things, inconsistencies, riddles, questions that needed to be seen around Whitley and his work. But in the process, because this is always the process for me, I went so deeply into the Whitley rabbit hole that I ended up turning myself inside out. not completely, obviously, just in a small way, relative to Whitley and the effect he's had on me and the appeal that he had for me. But so it's kind of like, in to a certain extent, all the stuff I've done in the past, there's a temptation or a desire for me to disown it and say, well, this is actually not it, like I've done with the blogs. I'll post for a while, and I'll do this and that, and then I'll say, this is not it, this blog is now closed. And this is compulsive for me. And what recently I've set up this new website, one of the things I've done with it, besides creating a vehicle for what I'm doing presently, is I've tried to include everything I've done in the past there as a way of owning it and saying, yeah, this may all be flawed and I may be embarrassed by some of this, or just, you know, feel that it's not representative of my view of things anymore, but it's all part of one whole thing. It's like one artwork, but that's all it is. It's an artwork. I'm not, I was going to say I'm not Carl Jung. I mean, I do want to help people. There is that. And I do have a desire to bring about social change. So I'm not going to deny that, but that is secondary to being an artist and just enjoying an artistic process, using myself as my own raw material. And I think that that might create confusion for someone like yourself, that because if I was just an artist, just, you know, making pictures and fictional stuff, I presume you wouldn't have an issue with it in the same way.
I don't imagine so.
Yeah. Whereas if people take me as an authority figure in some shape or form, and if I allow them to do so, then that there is a different level of responsibility there, you think?
Indeed. You know, you suggest to me another theme that I had intended to talk about. It's another convenient segue. I think that the path of the philosopher, or the trajectory of the history of philosophy, has been shaped by a peculiar tension and between the philosopher conceived of as artist and the philosopher conceived of as scientist. The artistic conception of the philosopher leads us to expect the occasional extraordinary vision embodied in the work of some great genius, whereas the scientific conception of the philosopher leads us to expect teamwork, integrated research, consensus about aims and methods. And yet, it's really never been either of those things. Because if you think about it, there isn't any discipline at all in the world that doesn't call for both method and synoptic vision if you're going to be truly great. A real artist exercises methodical care in technique and principle, methodically exploring the possibilities of a particular framework. And indeed, a real scientist requires imaginative vision. And, you know, that's, if you think of an Einstein, for example, that's what distinguishes a really great scholar, philosopher, scientist, a person on the margins. However, I think that this can be a defeating tension, or it can be a pregnant tension, or it can be a tension that makes the treader of the path somewhat lame. I think that you could also articulate it in archetypal terms, because there is a tension between, well, you could put it a few different ways, but you could say that there is a constructive, potentially pregnant, and potentially terminal tension between Saturn and Uranus. Saturn, on the one hand, is characterized as the principle of limit, structure, contraction, constraint, necessity, hard materiality, discrimination and objectivity, restraint, patience, factual concreteness. On the other hand, you have Uranus, which brings to mind the mythic figure of Prometheus and its embodied and experiment and creativity, originality, rebellion, change, liberation, freedom, reform, revolution. And I think that science, conceived of as the pursuit of truth, has always been made great by Uranus and Saturn having the right relationship. Because you could see, for example, people in the New Age community who simply make things up, who simply literally will propose this is a rule of nature or a rule of reality without a sense of obligation to submit to the constructive wisdom that actually can come out of consensus. And they wind up, to invoke a memorable phrase from the philosopher John McDowell, effective with frictionless spinning in a void. Because they have that unconstrained Promethean impulse, they simply shoot into space, but not in the positive sense of ascension, in the sense of being lost in an undifferentiated void. On the other hand, people who are over-enamored by Saturn can simply be dominated by consensus. But this tension, I think, reflects back on the first thing I raised about objective, subjective, and intersubjective truth, and how they need to be set in balance, and how the conception of the philosopher as artist and the conception of the philosopher as scientist needs to be set in balance. And I believe that I perceive a tendency in your work to confuse rational deductive processes with free association, to confuse the empirical process of mystical experience with something subjective.
That we've touched upon here, and probably the time that you've been following me roughly has coincided with this conflict or this tension. It's a conjunction, so it's potentially it's a unification, it's a harmonization. But because Uranus and Saturn are so inherently at odds, as you've just summed up, it's experienced like at the most gross surface level. I've had sciatica for the past 4 years. And that is Saturn. Saturn rules is the spine, rules the spine, and Uranus rules the nervous system, and that is exactly what Saturn is. It's the spine pinching the nervous system. So that, I mean, that's a beautiful example of just how real astrology can be, or the planet's influence can be. But it's also a way of, you know, making visible or tangible this conflict, and it's kind of archetypally it's a father-son conflict. sort of Saturn as the father that devours his children in order not to be replaced by them, and he castrated Uranus, I believe, for the same reason as the threat of Uranus's potency. I think I'm getting that right there, more or less, mythically.
I believe so.
Yeah, so that tension between the structure and the limitations and the consensual law and order reality of Saturn with the upsurging, rebellious, inventive, innovative, spontaneous, irrepressible truth of Uranus. That's exactly what I've been wrestling with. And you even mentioned lame, which if you take the word lame in its literal sense, then my father was in a wheelchair. He lost the use of his legs about this same period in his life. And I had sciatica, so although I haven't become crippled, I've definitely been somewhat lamed. And I would just say, I was going to use your name, but I don't know what it is, that this is absolutely inevitable. And I would say it's just we're all lamed, and so it's a question of how much do we actually have the courage and the honesty to recognize it and let others see it, to see it in ourselves by letting others see it. And that, you know, who is without sin to cast the stone? Like, who is Ken Wilber to say this about Carl Jung? Do we think that Ken Wilber is so much more beyond his own infantile wounds than Carl Jung to be able to judge? I certainly don't. I've got very little interest in Ken Wilber and a lot more in Carl Jung. And I don't think it, and this is the thing that people didn't understand about the way I looked at Whitley. You see, if you'd looked at my other interests, like Sam Peckinpah, say, the fact that Sam Peckinpah was an alcoholic and a drug abuser and a borderline schizophrenic in no way diminished his significance to me as an artist. On the contrary, it made it much richer and more vital for exploration. Like, what he had to bring to the world was so much more meaningful because he was a flawed, lost individual. And I'd say the same about Whitley. My objection with Whitley is that, like all of us, but I feel in a way that's restricting him overly, is that he's covering that up, that he's maintaining a personality that doesn't let its woundedness show. And so that's reducing the work, to my mind. I don't want to make this about Whitley, but just as an example of why I wanted to explore Whitley. And my attempt there was to humanize Whitley, to find the human being in all of this incredible, all of these incredible experiences that he was describing, to make those experiences and make what it was that he was testifying to more real, more accessible. But people, you know, people experienced it, some people, the opposite, that I was debunking, that I was exposing. But you see, I don't see it this way. Like Carl Jung, yes, maybe he was doing that, so yes, he's not somebody to follow, but I don't think anyone is somebody to follow, not even somebody who's fully enlightened. And I think that they are extremely rare, and I don't think that any historical figures, short of maybe Jesus, were enlightened. I think that the very nature of becoming a public figure and being driven to have a platform and to communicate and to be artistic and to have influence, I think that's generally symptomatic of, unenlightened, really. Right? But it isn't, it's like a movie. Like, a movie can have lots of mediocre stuff in and flaws, but you can still find something that's good in there that makes it worthwhile. So it's the same with an individual. They may be flawed, and their work may be getting filtered through these distortions and these delusions, and yes, it's important to recognize that possibility and if possible even identify the kind of delusions, but it doesn't invalidate the work. Not necessarily. I mean, to some extent, maybe, but Nietzsche was syphilitic. He couldn't get laid. We all know the truth about Nietzsche, but we still go back to Nietzsche. there's still something fascinating, compelling about the fact about what he wrote, including the fact that he couldn't live what he wrote. He couldn't live up to his own words. But that's true of every writer. Like, a writer imagines himself and he imagines the world through language in order to have something to aspire to. And if he's truly great as a writer, he's kind of sets himself up for failure. That's potentially tragic, but I think it's humorous too, really, because, again, the intellect, you know, the pen, it may be mightier than the sword, but it's still just a tool. It's still, you know, it's not the spirit. It's not the true, the power that moves things. It's not the power of creation. The pen can't create any more than the sword can create. They're destructive tools. Like Jed McKenna says, thinking is destructive, and writing is destructive. And what I'm doing as a writer is destruction, just like Blake. Not to put myself in camp with Blake, but I do feel an affinity with that. And it begins and ends with myself. I'm attempting to deconstruct the self, to destroy the delusions that come between me and a full body experience of reality. And there you have it. And yes, I want to be approved of, and I want to reach people, and I want to help people, and all these things. And to some extent, I've succeeded, and to another large extent, I've failed. And I'm just always keeping a score of, well, not score, but I'm always keeping an eye on that. And that's why I wanted to talk to you, because, you know, with you as an audience or as a reader or whatever, I've failed to communicate. You've ended up coming away with a negative. You see what's missing or what's wrong rather than what's there.
Well, I don't know if that would be an entirely fair characterization, because whereas the conversation you're thinking of is critical, it's not to say that nothing of value whatsoever is perceived, that the effort itself, that the journey itself, that the self-honesty and the self-disclosure and the grappling with inner and higher realities is not seen. You see, this brings me to another point that I wanted to make: enlightenment and the intellect, and whether the intellect is synonymous with the ego.
Well, I did say it wasn't, just to interject there, just that I associate them, and I think that they do work together diabolically.
And they can, but it can also be a catalyst for realization, for transcendence, for liberation, for awakening. I think that in the spiritual counterculture, there has been an over-identification of the intellect with the ego, with that which entraps us. I think that it is just as much a means of emancipation. After all, you yourself will frequently invoke the term discernment, but I mean something at once broader and more specific. As a Buddhist philosopher, I'm inclined to say that it's Kedrupje, but it could just as easily be Dharmakirti, but it's neither here nor there, who says that in order to perceive, if you wish to perceive the ultimate nature of reality without first mastering logic, this is akin to saying, I'm hungry, but I don't like food. And he goes on to say, if you wish to perceive the ultimate nature of reality, but you have not first mastered logic, this is akin to seeking to build a house but laying the foundations with bubbles. You're right that the intellect is an instrument of destruction, at least under the auspices of the metaphor that you're using.
Well, I didn't mean that as a negative, by
the way.
Well,
yeah, but let me continue. Destruction can be creative.
Yeah.
Only what is false, in the ultimate sense, can be destroyed. And it's in that sense that the intellect can be a vehicle of liberation. Now, I think not to prop up Buddhism as the way, the truth, and the life, but I'm going to speak under the auspices of that tradition in order to make a point. Because I think, you know, there's a comparative religion scholar who said all religions are the same, especially Buddhism. I think that it's a useful framework, if you're going to adopt a framework, which can easily be translated back into the language of other traditions, other philosophical systems. And the way that this particular tradition has been adopted in the contemporary American spiritual counterculture seems to have run with the phrase, get out of your mind and get back to your senses, which is not, you know, as the quote that I just invoked emphasizes, the intent or the character of the tradition. Now, why bring Buddhism into it? Because it's something that's thought of as being synonymous with just ground yourself in the present and stop thinking. And that, I think, in that sense, it's sort of an archetypal representation of how people think about spirituality writ large. I think that if we are too incautious with our language about the relationship between the intellect and the ego, then we've got a problem, because you've got people trying. If thought were the problem, then you could just hit yourself in the head and be enlightened. You could give yourself a lobotomy. It's not thought that's the problem. It's incorrect thought. It's not as if Jesus Christ and Sakyamuni Buddha and Lao Tzu couldn't form sentences. They're all very articulate people. It's that their thought wasn't constrained by false assumptions, because it wasn't based on a fundamental misperception.
Well, I would kind of vary that statement by saying that it was also, perhaps more so, that their awareness was not constrained by thought, that they may have had minds and intellects, and certainly did, that worked efficiently, and they were able to use them, but that they weren't actually confined or defined by the process of thought. So they would have been outside the thinking process rather than inside it.
I take your point, but that ties back into what I was saying originally. Said that there's this issue of this pre-trans fallacy. There's this issue of the devaluation of the intellect. And I think that that type of rhetoric is conducive of pushing people in the pre-side of the pre-trans fallacy.
Well, can I just interject at this point? Because I'm not really disagreeing with what you're saying. But I'm thinking of what Marshall McLuhan said, the medium is the message, and that, wouldn't you say that my work overall, although it may criticize the intellect, communicates a healthy respect for the intellect and a use of logic and of intellectual faculties in such a way that whatever, you know, the overt message might be, it's more likely to communicate that by its very nature. I love using intellect, I love using logic, and I think that that's a much stronger message. People respond to that, they respond to, and I think, you know, one of the things that's kind of life destroying about the intellect, or that's oppressive, is when it's heavy. You know, when it doesn't have Mercury's wings, and it's not fluid and spontaneous and playful, which it can be. You can have searing, ruthless logic, but still be playful and humorous. I think I haven't, I don't feel I've succeeded in that, really, but I've always aspired to that without relinquishing the, you know, the precision and the efficacy of the intellect and of logic to cut through the baloney and get to the truth so far as it can. I don't know if I agree that logic can actually take us to realization, but I certainly agree that it's a tool, it's an aid on the way there.
Well, if I can continue under the auspices of the framework that I invoked before, that being Buddhism, because I see it as sort of an archetypal representation of contemplative discipline in general. Again, just to state that. At no point in the original canon of Buddhist teaching does the historical Buddha actually equate mindfulness with bare attention. People have an idea of meditation that is much more akin to something that's considered to be a flaw in meditation, which is lethargy, which is a kind of a stupor. When in fact, in order to, for discerning mindfulness, to apprehend the nature of reality, it requires an active critical faculty running in the background of what you're observing, that is parsing through the perceptions, not necessarily in a verbal way, although there are practices to do that. But in, if I can give an illustration, they say that in meditation there are three faculties at work. There is mindfulness itself. There is the faculty that recognizes whether or not you've moved away from direct apprehension of the nature of of the present moment into, say, lethargy or distraction. And there is the will, because you can recognize that you've deviated from the present, from what you're trying to focus on, and still not act on it. So you could think of one of those faculties is sometimes translated as introspection. So we've got mindfulness, introspection, or metacognition, and the will. And the introspection and will are sort of programs running in the background, like on your PC, you have a program running in the background. So it's a more or less non-conceptual, unmediated encounter with the object of meditation. But at the same time, the intellect and the will are doing a kind of work to discern, to point, to do quality control, and to keep the mind in the direction that it's trying to go. There are other styles of meditation that explicitly involve the use of intellectual reasoning. We're all familiar, of course, with the process of the Socratic dialogue and how that would bring the participants to a place of aporia. And similarly, what the Tibetans will often do is carry out a process of intellectual reasoning, and they'll pursue a set of logical alternatives, like, let's say, the self must be either one with the mind-body complex or separate from the mind-body complex. If you hold that it's one with the mind-body complex, that yields a given set of implausible contradictions. If you hold that it's separate from the mind-body complex, that yields another set of implausible contradictions. And you can carry on with this line of reasoning or other lines of reasoning until you reach a moment of epiphany. And then what you do is you take that epiphany and you make it the object of rigorous concentration. And if you can get the timing right, you can enter into a non-dual experience of that realization that is indeed the authentic, unmediated encounter with the ultimate nature of reality. So this is a technique that people have carried through with for thousands of years. It's lesser known in the contemporary Western spiritual counterculture because, you know, in my argument, that's gotten bowled over by the, you know, be here now, get out of your mind and get back to your senses way of approaching this stuff. My point being that this is an example of how the intellect can be directly conducive to awakening and liberation.
Sure. Well, yeah, I think it's working one way or the other. The trick is, I mean, it's like with everything else, what is it that's directing the intellect? And what is it that's directing the mind? And, I mean, all of these techniques that you describe, I don't know. I would have to try them, and to try them, I'd have to spend years. I'd have to really commit to them. I'm not sure what we're discussing here, because I don't disagree with anything you said. I could question it, and I could question the premises, but your basic argument, I don't disagree with. The intellect is there. It's part of system, our awareness system, and it has a function. It's Mercury. It's one of the planets in the system. It's in retrograde right now, as it happens. And it's a beautiful thing. Now, but that doesn't take away, that doesn't dispute the fact that it can be abused, and it has been abused, and that because of individual and collective trauma, formative experiences, we've developed an identity that is, I don't know about centered around or based on, but certainly dependent on an intellect which is defensively oriented, that our intellect is used defensively to keep reality at bay. And I think that meditation can be used that way. I think that spirituality can be used that way. I think that everything can be used that way. And it's not exclusively if we're too intellectual about it. It just does seem to be that that's our bias in the West, for whatever reason, Descartes and beyond, you know, further back. It goes all the way back to Jehovah, in my opinion. In the beginning was the Word. We do have this bias towards the intellect, and so maybe the popularity of this, the sort of New Age mysticism of just get out of your head and into your senses, is an attempt to address that imbalance and compensate for it. And then it's like always, it becomes an oversimplification. And there are unknown questions about that. Like, what is the mind? What is thought? Where does it come from? Is it independent of the body, or is it just a bifunction of the body, like digestion? You know, because the lower animals don't think. They don't have internal dialogues. And what is thinking anyway? Is it the internal dialogue, or is it something underneath the internal dialogue? How is it that we can't control our thoughts? How is it that they arise spontaneously, just as gastric juices arise spontaneously? Maybe they're just as autonomous as other bodily functions. So for me, it's such a very convoluted area that the intellect is happy to get it, like a pig in shit, you know, to wallow around in there and think that it's going to find jewels. But my experience, although this may seem odd considering I'm a writer and I do all of this intellectual exploration, but overall my experience is that it's not actually that rewarding. And no, the intellect isn't the bad guy, any more than the sex drive is the bad guy, you know, or any other parts of the system are. They're all necessary parts, but they're not working together. So why? Now, that's another question. I don't know if we want to get into it. But my feeling is that we're not playing with a full deck. We're not aware of our unconscious patterns. We're not aware of the forces and the experiences that shaped us. And so we're really like everything we do to try and fix the problem, it's not effective, because we're not like, we're trying to do something from a place that actually can't do, like the Bhagavad Gita. We're not the doer. There's a process happening, and we are the process. So this, I think, is the upside of meditation. I'm not a meditator, and I don't have many opinions about meditation, really, except that I think that it's, if it's a doing, then it doesn't really change anything. But the positive of meditation is the observation, I think, the self-observation, and that there is a potential in there to observe one's thoughts, and observe what's actually happening, that can lead to more of a conscious control over where one's attention goes. Where do we place our attention? I mean, I wrote this recently. I don't know if it's true or not, or whether it's just one of these things that I come up with and then think, oh, that's it. But it was that free will, the only free will that we have is where to place our attention. But that the act of placing attention does have a profound change, because where we place our attention has an effect on what we place our attention on, first of all. And also, what we place our attention on has an effect on us. So if we put our attention on positive things, we feel more positive, to simplify. But also, conversely, if we look at something that we're ambivalent about, say it's a partner and we're having a difficult time with them, but we look at them in a way that is, our attention is going towards what we like about that person, that actually frees up space for that person to be that way. They feel appreciated, and they become more likable, more loving, right? I feel like I'm getting on a New Age podium myself now. That wasn't my intention, but it was just kind of to respond to what you were saying, because, as I say, I don't really disagree with it. I just think that the intellect, if we become too reliant upon it, then we lean on it, and then it gets weighed down. And the thing about the intellect is it has wings, it has to fly. And so it should never be uncoupled from the power of the imagination. But that's very hard for us. As we see them, we've created this dichotomy of objective reality, subjective reality. It's just your imagination, as opposed to this is logically true. You see, and I don't I don't recognize that dividing line because I haven't found it. I haven't found the line between objective reality and subjective reality, or between logical truth and imaginative perception. I'm not saying there isn't one, I'm just saying I haven't found it.
I think that it's a permeable membrane. I think that it's hard to put your finger on exactly, like if you consider the number line. If infinite quantities exist, and a good deal of modern mathematics is based on the assumption that they do, or rather I should say the finding that they do, then there must be some point on the number line where finite quantities give way to the infinite. But how could you ever stipulate that? Because any finite number plus one is another finite number. So where then is infinity? And a lot of things are like that, the distinction between objectivity and subjectivity being one of them. But just because we cannot say exactly where the line may be is not to say that we can't identify what is clearly on one or the other side of that line.
You know, I think it is, and it's just, well, I don't know. I mean, I think if we allow that we are under some sort of delusion, we don't know how great it is or how small, but that we do have blind spots, then how can we ever be sure that what we're looking at now isn't obscured in some way by that blind spot? Like, how can we actually know anything? I don't mean, beyond the absolute basic of what we're perceiving. Like, I am perceiving that I'm having a conversation with somebody in Austin, Texas. Yeah, I am perceiving that, but I don't know that that's actually what's happening. I know I don't want to get too abstract here, but, you know, you're talking about this line of certainty about something. And yeah, in a moment-to-moment basis, I do have certainties about things. But when it comes to actually writing it down, which is then you're putting it down in, you know, in some sort of semi-permanent form, I am extremely wary of, even though I'm actually a dogmatic person, I'm far more dogmatic than I would like to be, because I have convictions, you know, things that I feel very strongly are true. But logic so far, I mean, my most sort of powerful experience of logic recently has been my experience with John DeRuyter, and how I felt under the spell of my own projections. Like, I saw something in this man that wasn't actually accurate, and so that when I had to confront that, I had to then confront the reality of my own projections and the delusion that they caused me. And so logic then was an absolutely invaluable tool in that way, and it was a destructive tool. I used logic to destroy the misconceptions and the assumptions that I had accumulated, from which I had created this false projected reality. And I think that's a microcosm for everything that we're doing. And I think that until we get fully free of the viral implant of the ego, we're going to be in that boat to a greater or lesser extent. So it's like Thomas Anderson in The Matrix. I mean, in the movie, he only found out he was in the Matrix once he was free, but it's not like that, really, is it? We find out more and more, we become more and more aware that we're in this delusory tunnel that seems like reality but isn't, without actually being able to see outside of it. So it's like being in a chrysalis, and we're getting bigger and bigger as awareness, perhaps, or whatever, and so it feels like it's getting smaller and smaller. That's been a large part of my experience, that less and less, the more I discover, the less that I can be sure about. I mean, the impression I get from what you're saying is that you feel, I'm not going to make this a question because I want to try and sum up as you just did, but my impression is that you feel that science, that knowledge, that the intellect, that thought, that logic can actually lead to the truth. My feeling is that this isn't true, that this is actually a dead end. That it is a tool on the journey, but it can't actually get us the whole way. It can get us to the edge of the abyss, or we can build a bridge, maybe. I wrote about this in Lucid View, on the edge of the abyss, attempting to reach the other side of the abyss, but the bridge can only get us so far. It can't ever reach the other side of the abyss. It can get us to a far enough point that we develop the courage or the vision or whatever it is that's that we find when we reach the end of our tools, the end of our intellectual understanding, to make the leap. And when we make the leap, we leave everything behind, including the intellect, including knowledge. And this is something that I've been touching on recently with my synesthesia cinema, my little films about autism, my experience of the world, that knowledge is inessential to extraconsensual perception. And I would extend that even to what you're talking about, objective reality. Now, I don't actually know if there is such a thing as objective reality. That's like the tree falling in an empty forest to me. But let's say absolute or ultimate reality, I do believe in that. And I would say the same, that knowledge is inessential to an experience of absolute reality. I think that the animals experience absolute reality to some extent, to their limited capacity, that the mountains, that the clouds, that all these other entities and organisms are able to experience absolute reality. Human beings, we're taking a different route, and knowledge is part of that route, but we've possibly misconstrued the nature of knowledge into thinking that it's absolutely essential to an encounter with reality, rather than a way to to make a map, let's say, that helps us navigate the terrain up to a point where we realize that the map isn't the terrain, and then we throw away the map and we just go intrepid into the unknown without knowledge.